Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, sponsored by WebSpy. October 19, 2009, and this is episode 213. This is going to be the second part of the interview that Jack Andriss, the CEO of WebSpy, our sponsors, did with me last week on October 12th. I'm just going to play the second part. It was a pretty long interview. We spoke for 2 hours and 20 minutes. So even with splitting this in two, they're pretty long episodes. So thanks for sticking with this. Before I get into the second part of the interview, I do want to just quickly thank Jack and WebSpy again for their support, and to ask you, the listeners, to, if you use Twitter, to tweet the phrase "thanks to @WebSpy for sponsoring the @MartinBaileyPhotographyPodcast on Twitter to show your support. To find out more about WebSpy and their products, go to webspy.com/MVP. and use the discount code MBPWSY for a 10% discount on anything you buy. And here, though, is the second part of the interview.
Yeah. So we were talking about the next phase of photography for you. Obviously, getting back to when you were in the UK, you started to work in a natural environment. You got out of the city to take some of the photos. You said that, you know, certainly in the Lakes District and yeah. So forth.
Yeah.
And I imagine that's sort of the other aspect of it, moving to Japan and enjoying the beauty of Japan and the natural beauty and how different that was.
Yeah.
Also would have maybe been a bit of a magnet drawing you into that. So I guess nature photography continued pretty much throughout there.
Right.
And all that's growing and equipment's being added and so forth. And it gets to a particular point where podcasting starts.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, that you mentioned earlier about, you know, when did I get to where I to get as good as I am now? And to be honest, I mean, I think that the podcast has helped me so much with my photography as well. One of the things that I do when I'm out is I'm constantly thinking, how will I relay details of this shoot to the listeners? What the effect that has on me is, I'll start to check. I'll run my checklists through my head. I'm thinking, okay, so have you done this? Have you done that? And I'm doing all of this because I'm thinking of how I'm going to relay it to the listeners. And so I find myself sort of catching myself doing something that I shouldn't do just because I'm thinking of how I'm going to talk about it on the podcast. And so I definitely am improving all the time. I mean, I don't think any of us ever get to a point where we think we're there, and if you did, you'd probably start to stagnate at that point, and you'll be, you know, you won't get any better. But I think that, you know, all of the time the podcast is helping me to push myself forward photographically, artistically. You know, my pre-visualization is helped by the fact that I'm always trying to think about how I'm going to talk about this in the podcast. So yeah, it's definitely a huge part of it. I guess, you know, to talk a little bit about that was a happy side effect, I've got to admit. When I first started the podcast, I didn't think that would happen. But, you know, to go into a little bit of detail about why I started it, there were a couple of reasons. But the very initial thing, I mean, I was already very much into photography. I'd got my website up. I was posting images. And a friend of mine in England called Martin Rowan, he's still a forum member now, with the username Short Guy, Short Bloke, Short Bloke, sorry, English bloke over there. Basically, Martin emailed me and said, "Are you aware of these podcasts?" And, you know, he told me that, you know, Chris Marquardt was doing the Digital Tips from the Top Floor.
Right.
I took a listen, and, you know, and I mean, I don't listen anymore, I've got to admit. But initially, it immediately got me hooked, and I just loved the format. I thought that Chris is very sort of, happy and chirpy, and he's very dynamic in the way he records. But I actually didn't feel as though the content was quite as rich, or maybe a level or two lower than what I wanted to hear. Every so often he would come up with a real gem, and I think, I can use that. But 9 times out of 10, probably even more, it was just stuff that I already knew, and I was listening because it was Chris, because he's entertaining.
Yeah.
But also, I found Brooks Jensen's lens work.
Brooks Jensen's, yeah.
That's a good name. I've got to get it. So Brooks Jensen's lens work was the second podcast that I listened to, and that was deep. He got into the philosophy of photography, the art, the thinking behind it, and he made you think. And that was something else that I found really, really captivating. And of course
that's also a prize in the competition from
that you are kindly sponsoring. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lens Work, the podcast for me, along with Chris's, were the first two that I listened to. And I thought to myself, okay, so Chris's is really, it's dynamic, it's like happy, it's bubbly, it's really entertaining. The Lens Work podcast from Brooks is, it's deep, it gets you thinking. A little bit short, I was thinking, but of course, for what they are, Brooks has got an amazing ability to sort of to get you thinking about stuff with a very, very short podcast.
He does. Yeah, absolutely. And just on that point, that last podcast, I think it's his last one that he talks about, similar to what we were talking about equipment then, is that the gear has changed so much.
Yeah.
Yet his style of photography and what he photographs has not changed one little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the gear does affect the way we shoot to a degree. But I'll start to digress if I go off.
Yeah,
go
yeah,
to that.
Yeah,
so basically, what I did with this, the start of the podcasting, I just thought to myself, that these two podcasts are great, but I thought that there was something in between. There was somewhere in the middle where I could, I just thought that there was a space there that I could jump into, and I didn't think at the time that I would be doing it for 4 years, and I'll probably be doing it for four more. But I set it all up before I'd even figured out what I was going to talk about. Being a bit of a techie, I created a database and created a page to input all of the details of the podcast. I mean, excuse me, at the time, WordPress wasn't, at least from what I remember, there were no like off-the-shelf packages that would allow you to podcast easily. So I was basically built a system on my website where I can go in and administer the podcasts, change them, publish them and everything. All of that gets thrown into the database. One of the conscious things that I did from the start was I made sure that I set up the database with 3 digits for the episode number. So I knew that I could go more than 100. And so, that's a 2-year goal. I planned on doing one a week. So I made sure that I could go more than 100. But I did use 3 digits. When we get to 999 episodes, I've got a decision to make. But it'll probably just be increasing the record in the database to 4 digits and go to 9,999. I set all of that up, and then I recorded the first episode and put it out. It took a couple of goes to get the first episode right, and Martin was great. He gave me a lot of advice on, he said, yeah, this is okay. But actually, what I did was I talked about myself on the very first podcast, about who I was and what I was going to be talking about and all of that. And Martin Rowan said to me, don't talk about yourself first off. He said, you can do that later if people are interested. But, start, don't tell people what you're going to do. Just do it. So I did the first one, called it the Pink Flamingo Stare, and basically talked about one image that I had shot in a zoo here in Tokyo. And that sort of kicked off, you know, a discussion about the ethics of photographing in a zoo and things like that.
Yeah.
And the response was great. A lot of people picked up on it really quickly. There were very few other photography-related podcasts at the time. I only know of Chris's and Brooks's podcasts at the time. Of course, they've sprung up a lot since. But incidentally, I mean, people have asked me to talk about myself a number of times, and it's taken your prompting with this interview to actually get me over 4 years later to talk about myself. So.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, when we first talked about me potentially appearing on the podcast, it was to introduce WebSpy, but I thought that, you know, being a sponsor and those people that are interested in WebSpy will certainly, they will check out for themselves about us.
Yeah.
And that you do enough to introduce it, and probably the one thing that I like the most is seeing the tweets in appreciation of the sponsorship. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So I thought the last thing I'd want to do is bore your listeners about WebSpy when they want to hear about photography. So
yeah. Well, and then they end up listening to me talking about my brother and my policeman brother and my criminal brother and all of that. So.
But at least that's a lot closer.
Yeah, well, we're interweaving photography as well, so I guess I hope people are happy to listen to this.
Well, yeah, and certainly as far as podcasting is concerned, I mean, you know, it's purely a personal commitment that you've made, because it's certainly not paid. Yeah. It must take up a lot of time. I mean, the amount of documentation alone that goes into scripting, I know that recently you've sort of been going off the cuff, but previously I felt that you'd scripted every single podcast prior to recording it.
I still do. The only ones that I record off the cuff are either ones that I record snippets outside where I'm just somewhere and I'll make an audio note. But also the competition. When I take a look at the winning images from the assignment. That is something that I started to do more ad lib. But, you know, these days I'm actually scripting those a little bit more as well, mainly because I've started to post the transcripts on the blog, which is a little bit of extra work, but a lot of people were asking for that. I actually have five, I'm on my fifth, well over 200-page A4 document of transcripts. So, you know, there's enough in there. If I was to sort it out and edit it and maybe, you know, put it into categories, I've probably got 3 or 4 books in there, which I should get to at some point.
Well, that was a question I had for you as to whether there was a book in the future from Arden, but I guess that there potentially is.
Sure. I'd love to do a book, and I think that, you know, once I am able to put more time into photography, which might happen, before many years are up, but I will definitely do it. I don't see me doing that while I'm in my full time day job at the moment, just because I just won't have the time. I do have a lot of other projects that I'm into, but I think a book will take too much time at the moment. But it's definitely something that I want to do at some point.
Yeah, and so as far as time commitment to podcasts, I mean, I would imagine that there's probably at least one or two evenings each week that would be consumed in just creating the podcast
and
then documenting that. And then there's also running the forums and making sure that the background administration of those sites is operational. So what sort of time commitment do you dedicate towards helping listeners and forum members on a weekly basis, and including the podcasts?
I generally try to get into the forums at least once a day and answer any questions that people have got, or just, you know, I mean, there are a lot of great contributors on the forum. So, you know, it's not just me. I mean, generally I'll find that, a good friend over on the forums, Landon Michelson, is in the same time zone as a lot of people that ask questions. Also, Forrest Tanaka, both of these guys are our moderators as well. But not just those. I mean, there's just so many great people over there that just jump in and answer a lot of the questions while I'm in bed. So it's not always necessary for me to be answering questions, but I definitely try to at least get into all of the threads. And so, you know, anyone that comes along, asks questions, even if it's already been answered, I'll try and add my 2 cents as well, or 2 yen, or whatever.
Yeah.
But I generally, I'm in there at least once a day, and it can range from anything from 10 minutes to a couple of hours, depending on how much activity is going off. But I'm also sort of, I'm much more active on Twitter now and Facebook. We've got a fan page over on Facebook that has, you know, got a little bit of traction coming up there. Jack.
So effectively, overall, that's quite a large commitment in time on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
And then add to that planning for, you know, effectively your workshops, right, which would be a long term thing, would take up a reasonable amount of time prior to as well.
Right.
So I imagine that you don't have much time for any other hobbies.
I don't. I used to play golf. When I first came back to Japan, I played golf a little bit, but and when I was here before as well. But here in Japan, golf, one game of golf is a day long thing. You've got to get up at the crack of dawn. I don't mind doing that for photography, but I didn't particularly like doing it for golf. And then you've got to drive for 2 or 3 hours, and then you've got to pay $250, and then you've got to have a meal there and a bath, and then you get home after dark. And to me, the game of golf is something that you do, you know, you can get up early, go out, have a game, and then be in the pub at lunchtime, have a bite to eat with your friends, and then go home. And you've still got the afternoon and the evening. But of course, it only costs you £10 or so.
Right, it's not, yeah, which, you know, is probably the way that it happens in Australia.
Right. But I realized pretty soon after I got back to Japan, and I was really getting back into photography and just time-wise and money-wise, it wasn't going to work to do both. So, I mean, I do consider photography, everything that I do now, I've got various things that I do, but they're all related to photography. You know, so either, you know, projects that are related to it, or the podcasting, or the blog, and things like that. Everything that I do now with my spare time is, excuse me, is related to photography.
Yeah. And moving on, I guess, from a point that I've got here is into the workshops, because the podcast would have led into the workshops, especially with the access to the members that you're podcasting to, being a captive audience to promote the workshops too.
Yeah.
So, you know, tell me a little bit about the workshops and the drive behind that, because obviously the first one, you know, a lot of planning, the initial workshop, a lot of learning for yourself. Mm. Was that because other podcasters were also doing workshops, or, you know, is it something that you wanted to do for a while?
Now, I was really annoyed with myself when I first heard other podcasters talking about their workshops, because I'd been thinking about it for a long time.
Right.
And, you know, I was thinking, oh no, they beat me to it. And that's the same old story. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I hear people announce that I've got planned, or at least wanting to plan, but just never had the time to do it. You know, time is restricted, and at least while I've got my day job, I'm not going to be able to do a lot more than I'm doing right now. But I'd always planned on doing something like that, and I'd actually been on a very similar workshop to the one that I do, or at least the wildlife part. I'd been on a workshop with a friend of mine. I would probably be able to say now, Yoshiaki Kobayashi. He's a Japanese photographer who does workshops in Hokkaido, and I joined his for about 3 or 4 years in the winter, going up there and doing all of this stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, I know the places, I can maybe add a little twist of my own and do things my own way. But basically, the first one we did was roughly the same workshop that he took me on a number of times. And I felt bad to be honest. I mean, I'd done something so similar to what he was doing that I felt bad, and I contacted him. We'd been communicating offline for a number of years, and I told him that I was going to do this. And you know, far from him being annoyed that I'd basically, you know, stolen a lot of his ideas and locations, he was supportive. He was telling me the things that he thought about when he was doing this stuff. He said, "You've got to get here by this time. Have you thought about going to this place?" And he was really, right. really okay. supportive, incredibly generous person. And he still is. I mean, I meet every time we go, he turns up, he meets, he comes along and chats with the guys. You know, he could be charging me for some of the stuff that he does, but, but you know, I mean, I do him a lot of favors as well now. He released a book a few months ago. And I did all of the English proofreading for him and did a little bit of translation for his English in there. So we're like scratching each other's backs at the moment, which is one of the great things about the photography community. I love the way people share information. Most people, you know, there are.
Yeah, people, absolutely. Right. Collaboration is definitely something that's coming out as a result of a lot of the media that's out there. I mean, certainly Twittering on a very small scale helps that, but just, you know, podcasting and video casting and everything else that's going out at this point in time is seeing a lot of sharing in that, in this community.
Right. So yeah, I mean the where they're going to go in the future is really, at the moment, you know, the first year was 5 days, last year was 9 days, was 9 days, next year we're doing 10 days. Plus, we're doing the a Nagano Snow Monkeys shoot, so you know we've really got the itinerary just keeps growing.
Yeah. And there's also that secret location of yours.
Yeah, well, you know, basically there's a number of places that we, you know, that we visit that you know, you can't really tell a lot of people about just because they'll become overwhelmed, but I'm not secretive. Pretty much everywhere that we go, I talk about in the podcast.
Yeah.
There are the thing is, I mean, I know of a few places that I've been shown that I will never be able to take people to, just because they're, you know, if people know about them, then they will definitely become a new location on other people's workshops and things. And so, I mean, I will never even be able to take anybody to these places myself. But I do think that the places that we visit, you know, they're all open game. The people, pretty much anyone can turn up. I think that what will happen is that I'll probably, the numbers as well, we're limited to 12. We've got 10 people booked for next year, which is great. There are 2 spaces open if anyone that's listening is interested, but we've got another month or so before we close the booking. So if you are thinking of coming, then maybe make the commitment sooner rather than later. But I think that the 12 will be the max, basically because the infrastructure doesn't really help, doesn't enable us to take more than that. Some of the hotels can't give us more than room for 12 people. What I think what will happen is that I'll probably be starting to think of doing 2 workshops. If people, you know, if we get more traction, then I'll probably just do 2 workshops back to back, and then. And then just allow 12 people to come, so we'll have 2 at 24, and the season is long enough to handle that. It's probably even 3, but I think it'd be wishful thinking to think that I would be able to fill 3 workshops, especially with the current climate, because I know that some tour operators or photographers that are doing workshops here in Japan have backed out this year, just because of, you know, not being able to get as many bums on seats, as they say.
As far as the economy is concerned.
Right.
Yeah.
And the yen as well at the moment is very, very strong. Well, actually, no, I'm as they're saying on the Japanese TV at the moment, it's the dollar that's weak at the moment.
Yes.
There's not a lot at the moment that we can do about, you know, even the Japan economy is not the best in the world. It's made a lot of mistakes, but at the moment there's not a lot that they can do strategically to bring the cost of the yen down, because it's really being pitched against a weak dollar, and so the dollar has to get stronger before we. But that, you know, digressing a little bit there, but that's going to hit things. I mean, I know that people will be looking at the overall cost Because I actually charge in yen, because the first few years I was charging in dollars and I got bit pretty badly, by the fact that the yen went down, and I was, by the time I got the money into my Japanese bank account, which is where, of course, I've got to have the money to pay the bills, not just for me but for the workshop itself. I pay for everything in yen, so now I'm just asking people to pay it in yen. Just to protect me from that, but I'm aware that that will definitely affect things if the dollar doesn't get stronger soon.
Yeah, certainly. And so that obviously takes you away. I mean, from a family point of view, what does your wife think about the potential of running extra workshops and further time away?
Well, you know what? I think that at some point in the future, we're probably going to see me doing workshops in various countries, in the US, in the UK, in Australia, hopefully.
Right.
I mean, I look at the stats and I see where the majority of the listeners are. Actually, the number one country outside of the US, the US, over half of the listeners are based in the US. But the second largest is now India. I've got the majority of the second largest listener base is now India. And that's quickly followed by Canada and the UK and Australia. And also Japan's coming up more. I think there's a lot more, native English speakers in Japan that are starting to listen now. But I'll do more in Japan. Obviously, I mean, my strength is understanding Japanese and being able to lead a seamless, very smooth tour over here, because a lot of people don't come to Japan because of the language barrier. It's difficult to organize these sort of things.
Yeah, certainly.
So I'm going to be doing more in Japan as well, but also I'm going to start to do more in the various countries that I just mentioned. That's all something to look forward to at some point in the future, depending on how things pan out.
Right, okay. So, and of course you've spent a few trips, or you've had a few trips to India and spent a little bit of time there.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I love India. I would definitely like to do a workshop in India as well. Just because I love the people and the place. It's just, you'll know that I'm not a big street photographer. I don't cash in on the fact that I'm in Japan and that there's all of this, amazing culture around me, because I find that the people here in Japan are, although amazingly kind people, when you point a camera at them, they line themselves up with you. They go to attention, and it's either that, right, or you'll get a frame full of victory signs. and so I don't think that that they're that sort of photogenic as far as street photography is concerned. But what I do when I get out of Japan, I mean, the other thing as well is that I'm just so at home here that I don't notice a lot of the stuff that other people think is so evocative or
yes. Yeah,
it's my home. But when you put me in a totally different environment, such as India, then I find myself doing much more street photography, because it's so different to what I'm used to, and I find that the Indian people as well are so just photogenic. You ask them if you can take the photograph, and they don't stick a V sign, as in the victory sign, not the English. I'm not going to get into that.
I guess from your American listeners' point of view, I guess it's close to the bird sign, is it?
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't really like those photographs, but. When I'm over in India, they're just they're happy to let me take the photograph, and they're so natural, and even if they're not natural, even if they pose for the image and have a big cheesy grin, I just find it so nice, So I'll definitely like to go back to India with a workshop as well.
But you recently are getting back, or you're getting into a lot more people photography, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You tweeted about having four families that you just recently shot.
Right. So my love is nature photography, but I don't find nature photography to be, or landscapes and things like that, to be that good at putting food on the table. And although I, if I was to really concentrate on it full time, I know that I can make more money at it. But I think that there is a better revenue stream for taking portraits of people. And so what I've been doing is I'm trying to build a separate side of the of my business, my side business, whereas I'm going to be taking I'm not sure if this is a real term, but I'm calling them casual portraits, as in, you know, I don't want to get into the coming of age ceremony photographs over here, or the what they call shichigo-san, which is a 7, 5, and 3 year olds, where they, you know, they take the, if you've got a 7 or a 5 or a 3 year old or all three or whatever, you put them in a kimono and take them to the shrine or temple to be blessed. And then usually at the same time, they'll have the photographs taken in a studio. I'm not interested in that. In that, as in a studio-based type of photography. But what I am enjoying is taking, like I say, casual portraits, getting people in an environment where, I mean, because I do like portraiture. I don't particularly like street photography because of, you know, I don't really like walking up to people and asking if I can take the photograph. And when I do it here in Japan, even though I can get over that, and I do sometimes, you know, get over that sort of fear of rejection and stuff. But when I do, they generally do that stand to attention, and it's really difficult to get them to relax. But I do like portraits. And if I'm in a situation where someone's paying me to do that, and I, you know, they want a good natural portrait, then I can spend the time with them to get them that. And I'm enjoying the results. What I did was, I've also been doing I photographed Lem Fugit a few weeks ago that I podcast on. That was great as well. I mean, that was studio sort of portraits, but again, I just enjoy getting in there and making him look good. And, you know, I mean, he's a handsome fellow anyway, but just trying to make him look as good as he can. And I enjoy that challenge. But also, I mean, I'm going to be really pushing this casual portrait thing, where, like, what I did at the weekend. I mean, I've got to tell you, I didn't charge these four families for my time, but the location that we rented cost $400 for 4 hours, and I did ask them to pay for that. But also, what I did was I had them all sign model releases, and I'm going to be putting a website together to push this as another service,
Okay.
So, I'm basically right now building a portfolio of casual portraits. And that is going to be the next thing that I try to do, and I'm going to be you know, really pushing that as a way of giving me something to do on the weekends when there's you know, nature photography isn't really calling. You know, I've got weekends throughout the year where I'm not out in the mountains or I'm out at the crack of dawn waiting for the sun to come up. There are weekends that I could use to basically help to feed another revenue stream. And so that's what I'm working on at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. And we talked about some of the goals, and I guess that's certainly one of them. Mm. So probably over the next 12 months, you're going to get another workshop under your belt. Obviously, we're planning for the following workshop.
Right.
A little bit more into portraiture.
Yeah.
I imagine, as you said before, that there'll be at least another 4 years of podcasting.
So the podcasting isn't going to stop. There is one other thing, a huge project that I've been working on for the last 6 months that is almost to the point where I'm going to be able to announce it with a website and all of that. And this is folios. And basically, this is, again, a leaf taken out of Brooks Jensen's book. You know, Brooks has these wonderful folios that I just find to be a really, really good way to relatively cheaply bundle together loose images in a folio and just make them, you know, available for sale. And so over the last 6 months, I've actually been working with a company here in Japan, and in my rabbit hutch front room at the moment, I've actually, to my right, got two large boxes, each with 250 die-cut folio folders in there. They're die-cut and embossed with the, you know, the Martin Bailey Photography logo, and I've got some matting boards. I've got everything ready, and I've even got the images selected and two of the three sets proofed and printed. And what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to try and get a number of these together, get them all put together into these, like, folio boxed sets, and I'm going to be announcing the pricing and the you know, the contents of these three sets very soon. Hopefully,
oh, excellent. The next few weeks. And you're going to be printing the photos for these?
Yeah, they're going to be original prints. So, I mean, this is the difference between what I'm doing and what the Lenswork folios are. You know, basically, I mean, in this day and age, the word original print doesn't carry quite the same weight as it used to. You know, when you talk about an Ansel Adams original print, it means that Ansel himself actually printed it out in the darkroom.
Certainly.
Yeah. Right. In the digital age, you know, the most we can get is that I am the person that's done all of the proofing. I mean, I've never done proofing before, soft proofing. I've always just increased the exposure slightly and then just thrown them out of the printer, and they look great. But I have found that while, you know, in putting together these folios, that to get them as good as they can be has taken a lot of time soft proofing. And so, you know, basically the extent of the original print is that I'm the person behind all of the soft proofing, and I'm the person that's going to be here making sure that the paper doesn't have any you know, dust on it, and making sure that it's all flat, and feeding it into the printer and pressing all of the buttons. So it's not quite the weight that it would have been in the darkroom age, you know, where you printed your own images. But they are all going to be printed by my hand, you know, under my supervision. And so they're going to be slightly more expensive than the Lenswork folios. But, you know, because it is me that's totally behind all of these, I'm hoping that people will find that that's worth it. And they're all going to be numbered as well. So you might remember that when you first came on board as the sponsor, we wrapped up the last 6 months of assignments, and I promised Forrest Tanaka, the person that won, I promised him one of these. And so number one of one that I'm going to allow him to pick is going to go to Forrest. But then everything else after that, you know, number one for two other sets, and then after the other, you know, they're all going to be numbered. So when people buy these, they'll see which one it is. I'm not going to do limited editions, because I think that's, you know, to me, in the digital age, limited editions has no meaning. I don't care if people want to do that themselves. You know, one of my friends here in Tokyo, John, the guy that was on the podcast a while ago with the HDR, if you remember that.
Right. So, yes, I do.
Yeah. So John basically is he sells limited editions of his digital prints. If that's what he wants to do, that's fine. You know, I wouldn't put him down for that. But I personally don't agree in limiting editions of digital prints, because the reason for limiting them is not there. You know, originally it was because the negatives would eventually wear out. They would fade every time you blast the light through them to print them. The negatives would fade. So, you know, that it was a necessity. But in digital, I don't believe that's there. So I'm not going to limit them, but I am going to number everyone.
Right. Okay. And this is coming out, what, in about a month or 2 months?
Hopefully. I mean, I've been stuck for the last 2 weeks with a number of these portrait shoots that I've set up. But once I've got through the images that I've just shot of the four families, I'm going to be back to proofing my third set. And I've got two done. I've actually got a number of them already made in two of the three. But I've got to finalize the proofing on the third set and actually get that ready to, you know, to go into production. And that's probably going to take me another week or so. And then I need another couple of weeks to actually print out, you know, two or three sets. Because it takes me 7 to 8 hours to print out one set of three folios.
So amongst everything else.
Right,
so
right.
Imagine that, it's going to take a while.
Right. So I'm going to need at least, what I want to do is really get about 10 sets ready before I announce it, so that I can get the first few peoples out quickly. But then I'm pretty much, you know, if this does catch on and people want these, then I'll probably much be printing on demand. But I want to probably take a few more weeks to get that. So yeah, a month is about right. I would say that another month or so is when you'll see the announcement. And I want to do a website, to show these as well.
Yeah, right. Well, look, I think we've been going for quite a while, and I'm not sure how much of this you're going to include in, but
it's all going to be in there, I'm afraid.
Is it?
So
well, I had a couple more points, and I'll ask them. One was to do with general thoughts on photography, certainly as far as where it was heading in the future, as far as where you saw it heading. This is a personal view from Martin Bailey.
Yeah.
But before we get on to that,
yeah.
The intro music that you usually have to the podcast,
yeah.
Is there any chance that there might be some didgeridoo music on this one?
Yeah. You know what? I'll take a listen, and there probably is. I'll find it. I have the audio track from a video that was taken that I played in, I think it was 2003 or something like that, maybe around there. But I played at a Christmas party, and although it's not great, and I was really nervous, and I messed it up originally, and then I had to get back on track. I think I might put it in, and just to let people know what this is, what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I didn't mention this earlier because it's not an active hobby anymore, but I used to play the didgeridoo, which is from, you know, Jack's over there in Australia right now, and obviously the didgeridoo is from Australia. It's the Aborigine, one of the instruments that the Aborigines play. And I bought one, I think it was in a holiday when in 2003. I went over there for a holiday and I bought one, and then, you know, basically decided that I wanted to learn to play it. And I even had a few more made and sent over to me because I just love playing it. Being in, excuse me, in Japan, in these like rabbit hutch apartments, and there's people all around me, I stopped a while ago just because of the noise. I know that I was annoying people.
I could imagine the Japanese neighbors were just totally freaked out about this particular type of noise that was coming from.
Right. I mean, I was basically. Exactly. I limited myself to no later than 9 p.m. But still, I mean, you can't keep the noise down with these things. So, I mean, I used to play the saxophone, and you can't really muffle a saxophone either.
Right.
So, you know, there are things that you can put on them, but I basically, you know, I left that in the UK because it was too noisy. And yeah, the didgeridoo is something that I really like, and it's very therapeutic to play as well. You know, I got relatively good doing the old circular breathing and all of that, but I just didn't keep it up. And although I would still love to play at some point when I get my own house over here, you know, they're definitely not going anywhere. But I haven't played for a few years. But what I'll do is I'll find out the audio from that track that I had, and I'll probably put it into the lead in and the lead out, and so that you can have a listen to me playing my didgeridoo.
Perfect. So moving on from that, but sort of last area is you had a look at the latest releases from Canon,
yeah.
And I know that you and I discussed a few things that you felt about the way that the of camera bodies was heading towards, and I guess a couple of questions that I had, not only that, but just photography in general, is how do you feel the convergence of still and video? And what do you think you'll do in respect to HDR, or whether that will move into equipment itself, so therefore you don't really have to spend much time doing it. Your thoughts on how dynamic range is currently being covered and where it's moving, so related to HDR there as well. And, you know, low light capability. Obviously the D3 came out with a significant improvement in that, and not to mention that obviously the 5D was there as well with that earlier on. Where is that heading? Crop sensors.
Okay.
And yeah, just I guess your opinion on that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that, you know, the if I can, I'll try and sort of remember these. You have to remind me if I miss some.
Yeah, certainly.
But yeah, I think that cameras, the technology is going to just continue to steam ahead. I think that we're probably talking, you mentioned HDR and the dynamic range stuff. A few weeks ago, I mean, I did mention in one of my podcasts about what I would like to see with dynamic range. The same with HDR. I'll tell you what, HDR, I think that I don't want to see it in all cameras as a default. What I think is that the technology will get to the point where we don't need HDR as as opposed to, you know, as a way to increase dynamic range. I think what will happen is that the manufacturers will increase dynamic range to the point where it can cope with the, you know, with the really high dynamic scenes that we need HDR to capture at the moment. I think as an art form, HDR is something that people are not going to let go away. So, you know, I mean, that if you're a sort of person that is into HDR, then, you know, you're probably doing that because you like the fantasy look that it gives you. And some people are not taking it quite that far, but, you know, but they really sort of they enjoy the whole HDR thing. So that's not going to go away as such. But I definitely don't want to see that become the way that photographs are taken or captured by the camera. But what I think will happen is that dynamic range will increase. And I mentioned this a while ago. I also, you know, I did a few weeks ago, I put a podcast out about dynamic range. You know, basically the cameras at the moment are capturing around 12 EV or exposure values, 12 stops of light, so from the darkest to the lightest. And the human eye can see around 23 EV. And actually, you know, what happens is the human eye is clever in that it opens and closes the iris so that, you know, like the aperture of your eye. So when you look at something bright, it closes it down so that you don't like get the highlights blown out. And when you look into shadows, it opens it up so and allows the highlights to blow out. And a human eye actually only has about the same, if you fix the aperture, it has about 12 EV, which is about the same as the cameras at the moment. But because right. It can dynamically open and close the iris, you were talking 23 or so EV. But I think that before too long, the cameras are going to have 20, 25, 30 EV. And I personally think what's going to happen, and if it doesn't, you know, obviously something else will. But I think that we're going to see ISO, variable ISO by pixel. I think that at the moment you set the ISO for the whole sensor. It's 100, 160, 200, 300, whatever. So I think that what's going to happen is that every pixel will have its own ISO value. And in doing that, the manufacturers will be able to sort of really expand the dynamic range. And even if it's not that, they'll do something to give us 25, 30 EV. I did also mention that I think when that happens, I want to be able to limit the LCD because I think that having the plugged up shadows or the blown out highlights on the LCD helps us to look and visualize as we shoot. You know, you can throw the shadows into total blackness and that helps you really to visualize how you want to take the shot. So I would still like to be able to limit the LCD to say 12 EV. But I still want to capture as much as the camera can possibly capture. So when
in that particular case, you're almost doing a reverse HDR, where you have all that unlimited scope, and you're bringing it down to what you would like to represent in the
exactly
photo.
Exactly, yeah. So yeah, I mean the better low light capability, it's related to that. I think that we'll see variable ISO per pixel, and that'll help to really bring down the noise. Although we'll continue to get more higher ISO performance. Megapixels, I think that we're probably going to be, I mean, we're already very close to the limits of the resolution of the glass. A few years ago, I mentioned earlier Yoshiaki Kobayashi, the Japanese photographer that I am fortunate to know and have been on his workshops. One morning, around 2005, I think it was, we were in the airport in Tokyo waiting to go up to Hokkaido, and we were talking about the resolution, and he said, well, you know, if the resolution goes much higher, they're going to have to bring out a whole new range of lenses to cope with that. And, of course, over the last year or two, we've seen that. You know, they're bringing out version 2s of a lot of lenses. And each time they do that, they're in, you know, with the computer-generated sort of lens elements and, you know, designing these things the way they are now, they're able to make much more higher resolution images, lenses, than there were before. And basically what's happening there is that, you know, if the glass is not able to resolve the light to as fine a point as the size of the pixel, then it spills over into the next pixel and it gets soft. Even with me, I when I went to 21 megapixels, I found a couple of lenses that were not able to cope with that. I also found that my tripods were not able to support the lens quite as good as they need to be. The 300mm 2.8 was sharp as tacks with my old tripod on the 5D, but when I got the 1DS at 21 megapixels, it was soft. And the reason was that my tripod was not able to keep it all steady enough to, you know, to maintain the sharpness. And so I had to get a new tripod and a new ball head, but that fixed it. You know, that from then on, it was I was able to to continue to resolve at 21 megapixels.
Well, equivalently moving into that medium format size.
Right. I think we're gonna see 30 megapixels or so in 35 millimeter. I think that, you know, with Canon being able to put 18 megapixels in the 7D with a crop factor, they've taken that further than we thought that they were able to, because the old 50D was actually softer than the 40D because we thought it was out resolving the lenses, but it was actually probably more down to the size of the photo sites and things like that. But I think that, you know, they're showing that they can get up really high on the crop factor, so probably the 1DS Mark IV will come out with 30 megapixels, and I welcome that. You know, I don't subscribe to the you know, too many megapixels is a bad thing argument. I think that, I know from my own experience that when I moved to 21 megapixels, I could make much, much better at prints. Even at A3, you know, A3 plus 13x19, you can see the difference. You know, I've got shots from Hokkaido with cranes in the mist, and they basically, you know, the trees, you can see the on a large print, you can see the frost frozen on the branches on the trees. And, right. You know, you just can't get that amount of detail with 10 megapixels.
The sharpness of the small detail is the biggest point of difference.
Right.
I've certainly seen a comparison between the medium format and 1DS Mark III, and that it's even further noticeable.
Yeah. I do agree that we should not have more megapixels at the cost of noise. You know, I do think that at the same time as increasing the megapixels, if they can continue to bring the noise down, that's the ideal thing. I think that the G11 with less megapixels than the G10 is a pretty good win for the engineers, of course. You know, because the more megapixels thing was more of a marketing thing, but I do think as well that a lot of people say that you don't need as many megapixels. They'd rather have this. If we can have both, why not? You know, if we can have low noise, high ISO, low noise, and lots more megapixels, I'm all for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that covers the megapixels. It covers the HDR, the dynamic range, light.
You mentioned crop factors as well, right?
Yes.
So I don't think that the crop factor camera is going away. I think that there's a place for it. I personally, you know, I don't think that I will buy a 7D because I like the bokeh that you get with the full frame. It's slightly smoother. You can't get quite the same depth. You know, the depth of field changes when you go to a crop factor sensor. And I like the bokeh that you get with the full frame. But definitely, I mean, for bird photography, for wildlife, you get a bit of extra reach with your lenses. And there's a place for them, and I don't think that they'll be going away very soon.
Yeah, and as far as the list of questions I had here in respect to this area, one of the questions I had, which I haven't asked yet, because I think we've covered those points, unless you have anything to add to that, is... you know, I know a lot of the listeners to your podcast, well, I imagine that they would be serious advanced amateurs, amateurs to an extent, and then I'm not sure what the how many pros you have listening to your podcast, but there would have to be some, most definitely.
A fair number, yeah.
Yeah. So what do you consider in your eyes as a professional photographer?
Someone that can get results every time. It, you know, consistently good photography. You know, I find that anyone can get a great photograph every so often, but being able to do that consistently, time in, time out, is really, to me, the the mark, the, you know, the sign of a professional. Of course, you can put monetary like limits on it. You know, like Canon in Japan only class you as a professional photographer if you make over half your, excuse me, if you make over half your income from photography. They won't let you into the Canon professional services thing unless you produce a tax slip that shows that over half of your income is from photography. I think that, you know, I mean, I class myself as a semi-professional because I still have a full-time day job, but I think that my standards are classed as I can class myself as a professional because I'm able to get, you know, quality images every time. There's little left to chance. Of course, it depends on what I'm shooting, but I was asked a while ago, you know, how often do I leave the house to take images, you know, to do photography and come home with nothing that I really, really like. And it just doesn't happen anymore. There used to be times where I would spend a day out, I would get back and I'd be disappointed that I had nothing that I could post on my website or anything that it was a good enough quality to post on my website. These days, it just doesn't happen. If I go to where I know what I want to shoot is, then I come away with the image, and that to me is you know what I would class as a professional.
Right. Yeah. Well, it certainly makes a lot of sense to me. Certainly as far as being able to reproduce the quality in the images and I guess tapping into that knowledge and experience that goes with the proof of being able to do that.
Mm.
That makes a lot of sense. So, speaking of photographs and photographers, then, what's your favourite photo and why? And do you have any inspiration from particular photographers?
My favourite photo of someone else's,
or no, yours,
mine. It changes, but it's usually an image that I've shot within the last year. I find that, you know, the older the images get, the less I like them because my standards gradually get higher. Probably still my favorite image from this last year is Distant Dance, and that's one with the crane dancing way in the background of the frozen scene. That, you know, I'll probably drop this into the podcast if I remember, but. It's one that I've spoken about a number of times. You know, you've got all of the frosted trees, and you've got the mist on the lake. So up there in Hokkaido from this year, that is actually no, it's from last year. So that's about a year and a half ago now. But that's probably one of my favorites of recent years. But I really, it changes a lot. What I find is that I have as I get, you know, move forward in my photography, it kind of replaces itself. I mean, I'm really enjoying the bokeh on the new 100mm macro. So at the moment, I'm finding that all of my screensavers and things are becoming, you know, this beautiful dreamy bokeh that we get with that. And so there's probably one of those two images that I put in the last podcast is probably my favorite at the moment. But they, you know, it really changes.
Yeah, imagine the style that you have, shallow depth of field. You would never have to worry about sensor cleaning,
right? Well, it sometimes gets in there, and you know, and every so often I do sort of close down the aperture and go, you know, when I'm doing landscape work and things like that. So, but sure, I mean, when I'm shooting at wide open, you can have a pretty dirty sensor, and it doesn't make much difference.
Absolutely. And what about photographers?
I actually, you know what, I would love to say that I have, you know, a lot of Western names that I can come up with, but one of the first people that really influenced me, I mean, I looked at a lot of his work. One of the first people is a guy called, I think it's Takeuchi, what's his first name? Toshinobu. I forget, but there's this a Japanese photographer that I really, really enjoyed when I first got into photography when I first came to Japan and got my first SLR. But also one of the people that I really respect the work of is another Japanese photographer who I visited. The first time I went to Hokkaido with Yoshiaki Kobayashi, who's also another great photographer, but the first time I visited, there was a guy called Yokoyama Hiroshi, Hiroshi Yokoyama, if you put it in the first name first. And he is also, he's got beautiful sensitivity in his images, and he's a wildlife photographer now. He used to be a professional sports photographer, winter sports, but he has some amazing, very sensitive images of the cranes and the eagles in Hokkaido. I also like, I've got a number of Tony Sweet's books. He does these really nice flower shots and very dreamy bokeh, and he uses a lot of filters and he puts like textured glass between the background and the foreground image, things like that. He uses a lot of tricks to really sort of make very dreamy images. So I like Tony Sweet's work as well.
Yeah, okay. And I think probably at this point in time, I'd like to say thanks so much again for the podcast over the last 4 years.
Not at all. Thanks for listening.
That's the easy part. And it's certainly been a pleasure discussing some aspects of your personal life, which I think, maybe otherwise would not have been revealed.
Yeah.
And maybe shouldn't have been revealed.
Hopefully my second brother isn't listening. My first one won't mind. I've got to say, though, even though I say that, I love them both. They're great. And I've got a kid sister that we didn't really talk about as well, but Pamela, her name is... so they're great. They're a great bunch. So I definitely can't say that any of them. I don't love any of them any less because they've been in prison and stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sure the listeners will find some aspect of this very interesting, and I hope they're not too bored by me running the interview for you.
Absolutely not. I've got to say again, thanks for thinking of doing this. It's been great talking to you. We've been running for over 2 hours now. I might end up splitting this into two podcasts, just to sort of spread it out over a couple of weeks to let people have a chance to digest it. But really, thanks very much, Jack, for taking the time to listen to all of the podcasts for the last 4 years, and then also taking the time to work with me on the sponsorship, and then today spending a good couple of hours in your day to. I know that you're actually at work now, so it's. I hope I haven't sort of kept you out of any meetings or things, and everything over WebSpy is still ticking along nicely without your close attention.
Oh yeah, it certainly is. We're about to do an acquisition, so that's certainly taken up a lot of my time in recent weeks. But we are moving forward, and it's been a pleasure sponsoring you. And I think that, as we talked about initially in the sponsorship side of it, that there is a feeling that there's a high correlation between some of your listeners and certainly the IT industry. So not only was there an interest in photography from our end, but there was also this understanding that the IT correlation existed amongst the listeners, and felt that was worthwhile trying out. And I think that it's certainly proven itself to be successful enough to continue.
That's great. When you first contacted me for the to talk about it, we did talk a lot about that, and I think that there's a lot of people that are into digital photography that have an IT background. I know a lot of people that work in IT in their day jobs and then are excellent photographers, and when they're not in the day job. And that's exactly what I'm doing right now. How long for, who knows, but I think that there definitely is that connection. So hopefully it's been good for WebSpy as well as me.
Certainly has.
Great.
So thanks very much, Bud.
Okay, thank you. I'll look forward to talking to you again, Jack.
Absolutely.
All right. Bye bye. Okay, so that's it. That's the full interview now, the second part. Sorry, it was a little bit self-indulgent at parts, but people have asked me to talk about myself a few times, so I thought it was a great chance with Jack's idea to actually get into that. So hopefully you feel as though you've learned a little bit about me. And there was plenty of photography-related chat in there as well. So that's about it. To keep up with me outside of the podcast, I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and of course the photography forum at MVP, the main site, martinbaileyphotography.com. And the photography forum is a great place to mix with other photographers, and it's a great place. Everybody's very professional, no flaming and all of that you get on some forums. So do stop by and take a look if you're interested. But that's it. I'm going to get off and leave you to it. And in the meantime, you just have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye bye. Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com. I'm going to go to the hospital.